Blog Talk Radio.
Because we're the Houston Oilers. Houston Oilers. Houston Oilers number one. Yes, we're the Houston Oilers. Houston Oilers. Houston Oilers number one.
Farm.
Hello, everyone. You're listening to Balvard Radio. My name is Matt Weston, and tonight I'm joined by the biggest, fattest, and drunkest on the mall, BFD. Hey, dude, how's it going?
Hey, I'm not drunk yet, but, you know, by the end of the show, I'm looking like things will be successful as we talk about the Houston Texans are 0-3! Woo!
Man, I wish I could drink and do the podcast, but I got this, my tongue gets too big in my mouth. I turn to Shan Sharp. And I can barely be understood to begin with, and even if I drink one beer, it doesn't work out. So I'll drink a beet juice along with you probably about 30 minutes into this podcast instead.
Wait, what is that? You say you drink a beet juice and have to poop 30 minutes into the broadcast? Is that how that kind
of
goes?
No, I'll drink beet juice, and I'll be drunk with you off nitrates 30 minutes into the show instead.
Oh, God, you're not doing the keto thing too, are you?
Probably in January, whenever I stop drinking for a while again, because I hate January and February. Lock myself in my room and just read books and, I don't know, watch The Sopranos.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. But that's a long ways away. We still have, I guess, 3 more months until that to happen. But before that happens, something else has already happened. Yeah, the Texans season's already over. So Houston lost 27-22, and it's just exhausting. They're on right now 2.7% of all teams since the 16-game schedule has been enacted and made the playoffs. The teams that finished 9-7 to make the playoffs, each one of those teams ended up going 10-6. The best record of those teams was some Chargers teams from the 80s that went 11-5 one year. So in this division, in this climate, they still have left. They haven't played Jacksonville. They haven't played some of those other separate teams on their schedule. You know, it's kind of over unless a miracle happens. So Houston lost this one 27-22. If you could point to one reason, one single reason why the Texans lost the game, what would that be?
If I were to point to one reason, and Matt, that's just such a loaded question because there's so many reasons. And so, again, I always like to say Matt does a great job prepping for the show, and he writes this outline. And when I see that, if you could point that first question, if you can point to one reason why they lost, what would it be? And I think I've got – I can't do one. I just can't. So we're going to talk about this quite a bit. So I'm going to say 1A is Bill O'Brien. And I'm going to say 1B is because the New York Giants did exactly what they thought we thought they would in the game, and they exploited our slow-ass secondary – with a bunch of slants that Kareem Jackson and Zach Cunningham couldn't cover Saquon Barkley out of the backfield. And they burned us, and their elite athletes showed why they're elite and showed why our defensive backs need to be replaced quickly, Matt.
Mm-hmm. I think giving up 27 to the points, the Giants wasn't too much. I think Houston could have eclipsed 27. So I'm going to blame it on Bill O'Brien, the continued negligence regarding the offensive scheme. And, you know, we talked back in, you know, March or April or so about the comments O'Brien made that he was going to continue to evolve this offense, that they couldn't do the same things that happened last year in fourth count. And I was ecstatic whenever that happened because it was an unsustainable offense last year. Watson had a touchdown rate of 9.3%. So I've been harping on since, you know, this big discovery came to me back in January last year or so. Whenever we had that discussion, you said, well, hopefully it doesn't mean that O'Brien's just going to go back to his previous offensive scheme that he's been running since he was the head coach of Houston. And I thought there was no way that was possible. I thought he would just expand more upon what already worked instead of just kind of doing things last year. And what you were concerned about ended up being the truth. The Texans are still running the exact same offense that they ran 2014, 2015, 2016. Whenever they were, you know, the 30th best offensive in football those 3 years. I think in 2014, they were like 22nd offensive DVOA. You know, in 15 and 16, they were about 30th or so. And he went back to what he did before that didn't work. And now the Texans are running this offense of stagnant. That is probably like, they're probably scoring about, you know, 70% of the points they actually should score. And it's all because of the offensive coordinator, which happens to be the head coach. So I'm going to continue to say that, you know, it's this offense and this offense's inability to just do anything correctly at all whatsoever is why they lost this game.
Yeah, it feels like, Matt, it feels like that not only is this horse dead, it's been a puddle, but it's been a puddle for a couple of years. Because, I mean, look, if you and I, just two guys in our mother's basement who blog about the foosballs, can see this stuff and see it so obvious, then how can the professionals not see this? I mean, even if you're Bill O'Brien, how do you go home at night and say, I did a damn good job, I'm going to do the same thing next week? How do you do that? I mean, if I were to do my job as poorly as Bill O'Brien does his, nobody would ever hire me. I mean, I would be the laughingstock, because right now Bill O'Brien is the laughingstock of NFL coaches. Jeff Fisher thinks that Brian O'Brien is a poor head coach, Matt.
Yeah, and I mean, that's a great point, because, like, I'm not a football super genius. You're not a football super genius. I think just about everybody who writes about football, you know, probably is a football super genius, but still, like, you know, it's something hard to, I guess it's something that's hard, but, like, you sit there and watch, and if you look at enough numbers, you know, patterns start to emerge. And there were so many things coming into this one that were just like,
uh-oh, you're gone.
You help out on your edges because both tackles have struggled mightily. Maybe stop playing Julian Davenport at right tackle, where he hasn't shown any ability to play that position at all after playing left tackle his entire career, all of last year, all of preseason, all of training camp, and then just switching him on a whim. How about you run some sort of route combinations to get your receivers who can't be man coverage open? Why don't you run the zone read, because that has worked really well against the Giants this year, especially when they bring Landon Collins in the box to stop the run game. Why don't you run over the tackles and get over the edges, because they have, you know, their biggest weakness on their defense is their linebackers. So when I put them 1-1 situations and you know, try to make them miss, you know, it just keeps going on and on and on. And it's just really kind of dumbfounding. Why not use Deshaun Watson as a runner at all whatsoever? Because that's why the offense worked so well last year. Or even Riot, why not run play action? They were 30th in amount of plays that they ran play action on, entering, you know, week 3 after being such a good play action team last year with Watson as well too. So I mean, I really don't know. I understand it. It's all like just so stupid, and it continues to be stupid. And I think part of it is just kind of like the head coaching culture that's existed for so long, where it's super risk averse. You're trying to do the bare minimum to win, because if you take a shot and take a risk and lose, it can fall back on you more so than not doing anything at all. And that's what O'Brien says in entire career, just do the bare minimum to win games. And now it's finally caught up to him. And the mirage is over. And you know, this is kind of what's happened so far this year. But I don't know. It's all just so very dumb.
Yeah, I mean, just go back and look at the last game against the BSS, and we were playing for a field goal. I mean, this team doesn't go for the throats. They go for, like, a pinprick. And it's amazing, because that's what he was doing in that on that drive that failed. I can't remember if it's the third or fourth quarter at this point, but with the drive with the two screen passes that ended, we went backwards, got ourselves out of field goal position, and we had to wind up punting as we usually do, like on the 37-yard line. There's risk averse, but you cannot succeed without risk. And we've talked about this for several years with Bill O'Brien as well. The dude refuses to accept any risk he thinks is unnecessary. And so we don't go forward on fourth down. We punt way too often. We play for field goals while the other team plays for touchdowns. And that played out this weekend as we are down 20-9 because we kicked 3 dadgum field goals instead of taking a risk. And once again, we're swapping field goals for touchdowns. And that happens a couple times. Well, 20-9 means you're down 4 freaking field goals. So it's not – Bill O'Brien as a head coach, even if he had the best offensive scheme in the world, he doesn't. What does he do well? He's uber conservative, punts too often, poor clock management, poor game management, doesn't adjust at halftime. And there are still Bill O'Brien apologists out there. And that's the part I don't get. I still see in the comments section on the blog, Bill O'Brien and the team will be fine. LOL, what? So, Matt, you always ask me, did you know that question? Matt, here's my did you know question for you.
I'm ready. What is it?
You're ready? You're
yeah.
ready. What is Deshaun Watson's record as a starter under Bill O'Brien for your Houston Texans?
I'm going to go with 3-6.
You are dead on correct, sir. Deshaun Watson, as gifted as he is 3-6 as a starter under Deshaun Watson. And we've been led to believe, Matt, that Brain O'Brien equals love forever.
Mm-hmm.
The Texans have won one game in their last 13 games, Big Matt. One game. We beat Blaine Gabbert-led Arizona Cardinals in Week 11 last year. We have lost every other game since Week 8 of the 2017 season. We are 1-13 during that span. How is Bill O'Brien not to blame for this? A lot of it's Rick Smith. A lot of it's Rick Smith. But how do you not blame Bill O'Brien for this, Matt?
Yeah, and I mean you have to at this point now because he won the power struggle. He was, you know, he was able to use him as a scapegoat, like how he used God's, he was a scapegoat in the past, like how he used the other quarterbacks previously as a scapegoat. All of which have done, you know, Fitzpatrick did better outside of Houston. I guess you really can't say that for Hoyer or Mallett, but have you seen other players, you know, who've gotten better since they've left Houston? Players who've come to Houston become even worse as well too. So I think that whole kind of question they answered about, you know, anything regarding is this Rick Smith's fault, O'Brien's fault? It seems pretty obvious that it's O'Brien's fault now. And I think the one thing about his conservative nature, like it worked and it had to, I think it's the one way like you could kind of win games in your quarterback is, you know, Brian Hoyer, Ryan Mallett, or name redacted, or whoever, you know, is the 32nd worst quarterback in football at the time and you have a top 10 defense. It's just what you have to do to scrape through and even, you know, win a bunch of close games. But when you have Deshaun Watson, that's not what needs to happen at all anymore. It's not like a luxury to throw touchdown passes anymore. It's what you should just always be doing. And now you're looking at teams like, you know, the Rams, where they had 500 yards of total offense while being up, you know, two touchdowns pretty much the entire game against the Chargers, and they never let up. You have the Chiefs who are scoring 38 points a game. O'Brien isn't doing that, and you've seen how much success other coaches have had with young quarterbacks. And also how many points they score, how many points they keep going and keep pushing and putting out there. And O'Brien hasn't done that all whatsoever. He's just trying to do he's trying to win in the safest way possible continuously. And it's not working and it's not, you know, going to change really at all. I can't see it really changing at all either.
No, because you're seriously asking the Tiger to change his stripes and or maybe in this case, the Tiger to change his spot. Because what is he going to do differently? He's not all of a sudden going to wake up one day and go, you know what? I'm going to salt and pepper my eggs. He's not going to do that. Like, those are too spicy for him. So it's time to go out. It's time to find. It's been time. I made that argument last year that it was already time to go do that. It's beyond time. Because if you look at the context of this, and the one that we like to pick on the most, Matt, and just to reiterate it, because I'm going to keep beating multiple dead horse after dead horse after dead horse, because what else are we going to do? We've been beating them for 5 years under Bill O'Brien. But we've pissed away J.J. Watt, another season of him, and J.J. Watt is playing some bad football right now. He is one bad dude. I am so glad I do not play right tackle in the National Football League and having to face J.J. Watt. And we're wasting it again.
Yeah.
And so that's the most frustrating part for me, Matt.
Yeah. I may have talked about this last week. I can't remember, but that was my feelings of Brian during this year was that, you know, one, I don't like him mainly because of 2014. And I still can't get over the fact that like they consciously went in 2014 with Ryan Fitzpatrick as the quarterback, considering that it wasn't a 2-14 team that wasn't talented. It was a 2-14 whose quarterback completely lost his arm, who lost a ton of close games, that had the, you know, best defensive player in football and a lot of talent on that roster, good offensive line, good running attack. And the biggest difference was the quarterback. And I still couldn't believe that they punted on 2014 like they did. And then all the consistent misuse of the quarterback position from there, where you, like you said, like they wasted J.J. Watt's prime. They wasted, you know, three of the greatest defensive seasons you're ever going to see from any player, and I think you'll kind of ever see in a way, and especially with the way quarterbacks are being treated now. And then also during that entire time, there was such of like an arrogance about him that he had that, you know, just he was just rude. He had that vibe that he knew what he was doing, that he was smarter than you, but he isn't at all. And he just constantly keeps making the same dumb decisions, the same dumb mistakes. And it keeps trying to force his own way of football, try to, you know, skate his way past through games and win games in like I said, the safest way possible. And I think when the kind of the best way for me to describe the Bill O'Brien era was in this game specifically. It was 2nd and 10. He challenged an 8-yard catch that made a 3rd and 2 that the receiver looked like he caught completely. And even if he didn't, you're not going to get much reward out of getting, you know, saving 8 yards in the second quarter. And the Giants are only about like the 35-yard line or so. So they lose the timeout to lose that challenge. Then going into the half, the Texans are driving to try to score. They run out of time, of course, have to kick a field goal. And the biggest reason why they ran out of time is because they lost the timeout because of that stupid challenge earlier in the game. And then later in the game, Saquon Barkley catches a pass that looks like he bobbled it. Aaron Colvin definitely thought he bobbled it. It looked like the ball was kind of moving as he went down. Rather than – he called a timeout to stop the clock. I know he was trying to coax a challenge or if he was just calling timeout. But why not just throw your challenge flag there? You're not going to do anything with your challenge flag here in 12 seconds because the 2-minute warning is about to happen. And then also, if you lose a challenge, all you're going to lose is a timeout, and you're going to call that timeout anyways. And, of course, they don't, and the Giants end up scoring a touchdown right there to put 27 points on the board to make a 2-possession game, and it's over. And it's even like those aspects where he's trying to call an offense, and he's trying to do something that he couldn't even do whenever he wasn't calling an offense. And he's super spread apart in that way as well because it's that continued arrogance that he can do everything, that he's super smart, that he's better than you, and that whole aura gives off. And it's not true. It's the farthest thing from the truth. But that was one of the, you know, even everything else we listed earlier about why Houston lost, I think that kind of just something that's so simple and so easy to do. And it's the same type of mistake he's also continued to make as he was a head coach as well.
I got one more. Did you know, Matt? Actually, you have to guess this one. I'm sorry. I'm going to be cruel. So the Texans have gone, as I said, 1-12. We've got one freaking win in our last 13 games. How many of those games, Matt, were one possession games?
That they lost?
We didn't win any of them.
Yeah. So in all those losses, I'm guessing, I know they've lost all three of their games to start the year were one possession losses. And I feel like they lost 6 last year. I'm going to say 9.
So out of the last 13, 6 have been one possession losses.
Gotcha.
So do you remember back in those halcyon days that you and I talked about how freaking lucky the Texans were on one possession games?
Yeah.
And what's happened now. So not only was he lucky, Bill O'Brien lucky, the Texans lucky for, it was about a season and a half. We were really lucky on one possession games. But the rubber band, when you stretch the rubber band out, it has a tendency to snap back. We call that regression to the mean. And that's exactly what's happened. The one possession wins were not sustainable, and the rubber band has snapped back with a vengeance right back on Bill O'Brien's thumb. 6 one possession losses out of the last 13 games. That's pretty snappy, Matt.
Yeah. And that was in 2017 especially so, and they won a ton, or 2016 especially when they won a ton of close games. So then they were kind of average in 2015, but 2016 especially so. And I know a lot of people kind of, at the time, I've done arguments and trying to tell people that, you know, these things kind of tend to balance out. Now I was constantly told that, no, this is an example of why Bill O'Brien's a good head coach, because he's able to win these close games. And that's not how it works. You know, it's never worked like that for any head coach out there. The good head coaches are the ones who win by 2 touchdowns and 3 touchdowns.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. All the shies that we've said over the past couple of years about why Bill O'Brien is possibly not a good coach, and it's evolved into, well, for me, it evolved quickly into that he's not a good coach at all, and you've kind of come around to that point too, not saying you're wrong to have that opinion, whatever. But it's pretty funny how the arguments we made for why he wasn't a good head coach have all borne out to be true. And I remember those seeing those arguments. No, that's sustainable. That's absolutely sustainable because Bill O'Brien is an above-average head coach. If you look back over the course of baseball history, football history, there is no credence to that at all. None.
Mm-hmm.
The stuff balances out, Big Matt.
Yeah, I think my favorite thing I said about it was that I think I said the 2000 – everybody's expecting the 2017 Rangers to lose a bunch of one-score games after they won a 10 2016, but nobody's expecting the same thing for the Houston Texans, and it's entirely because this is your team and your boys and your guys, and that makes it special compared to others. I will say this about Brian, though, is I did think that he should have been kept on for another year this year. We talked about this as well this summer, that I would never have extended him because if he did a good job, you have to pay him a little bit more money, so what, but he's going to stay. If he has a bad job, you're not having to waste all of your own money and release him anyways from a contract that you're forced to pay continuously. And he hasn't shown anything really that he's done over the previous 4 years to, you know, keep him for 5 years down the line. But he had such a good, you know, six-game offensive stretch with Watson. I guess five, really, because that Cincinnati game really wasn't that great. Watson just made one big run. The defense was very good. But in the five-game stretch, you know, Watson was spectacular, and he switched the offensive scheme around, offense that, you know, worked to Watson's strengths completely. And so because of that, I thought, well, hey, you know, that worked out really well, and Watson is healthy. That's the most important part of this team, is having a really good quarterback, especially a young quarterback. Let's keep it together for another year, see how it goes. If it's bad, you can move on. If it's good, you can keep him. And it turned out that it's bad, and they can move on. And now they're probably going to move on, you know, here sometime this year. But now it's going to cost, you know, McNair a ton of money, which I guess doesn't matter really at all. I'm kind of glad he lost a bunch of money on it, making it that dumb of a decision. But, you know, everything that happened last year, the five-game sample size, and why this offense works so well, they're not doing. And I think the most frustrating thing for me watching this team and watching this offense is that everything that they know works and has worked, they're just not doing. I talked about, you know, using Watson as a runner to set the play action and throw downfield, even running like meaningful play fakes. Their play fakes don't mean anything at all whatsoever. Using Watson as a runner on those zone replays, actually running like a jet sweep where you can actually pick up yards and use that to fake other things, running at the ball outside the tackles. And I know, like, running route combinations between Will Fuller and DeAndre Hopkins, like, even that's a great idea. It took me until, like, 2 minutes left in the third quarter for that to happen. And then all the issues with tackles, you can do things to help them out, too. So, I mean, it's mind-boggling to me, the fact that, like, he had that success, and he had that success doing that. And then for him to go back to his old ways because he thinks Watson should be more of a pocket passer, I don't know. And the only reason I can think of is if it's for preservation's sake, so they're worried about his knee not being 100% there. And that I can understand, you know, potentially, but like, you still, like, at 0-2, like, you have to go for it. You know, this game is too important to lose and not go out and get, especially with your roster healthy the way it is as well too. So I don't know. It's all very stupid. It's all very frustrating. It sucks. And it sucks that, you know, we as fans and people who care about this team and like the game had to wait a year for this to happen. Now that it's happened, it's already been wasted. And that the rest of the season, and if you're fine joining the Texans winning football games, it's not going to be there, and it doesn't exist already. And it only took 3 weeks for that to happen.
Right. Well, at this point, I feel like I'm Frank Bush, and that I've completely blown up Gary Kubiak's script by my defense giving up a lot of points. So if you want to hop back on script after my ranting, let's do that.
It's all good. Sometimes it happens. I feel like that was a lot of, you know, we try to have fun on the show, try to, you know, have a good time and you talk about the enjoyable parts of the game rather than, you know, kind of this sort of talk. And this just kind of happens, though, whenever you're in such an awful situation and seen such awful football for the past, you know, 3 weeks. But is there anything that you've really enjoyed, you know, about this game? Is there anything that you've enjoyed about this team? What was something that you liked from this game before we start talking about kind of more the in-depth analysis again?
I think there's two big things. And the first big thing, and not the biggest thing, I'm starting with the number two first, is watching Will Fuller play football and be healthy is a lot of fun. Of course, that was kind of the knock on him coming out. If he has the chicken legs, he's not really built for NFL football. A lot of guys aren't and are successful. I mean, you can see that. You know, not everybody can be freaking Darren Sproles, right? So there was a lot of questions if he was going to stay healthy. He missed the first game of the season, but watching Will Fuller play football is really, really fun because he's just too fast. He's like, he's your 99 speed guy on Madden who is just going to beat everybody to every corner. And it's a lot of fun watching him play the football, and he's not dropping everything. So that's also nice.
Yeah, I am.
But how do you not love J.J. Watt? I mean, how do you just not man crush on watching J.J. Watt? He was absolutely invisible that first quarter in the first game. And since then, he's been pretty vengeful, Big Matt.
Yeah. Yeah, I think those are kind of like the only two things that have been enjoyable. Because, Hopkins is still great, but he's being bracketed on every play. So they're covering the safety on top, and they're playing man underneath, and they're playing really physical man coverage as well, too. And they're not also, they're not even giving him the chance to make those catches in traffic he's made his entire career. Like, whenever they're playing press man, they swarm to the top, they're just ignoring him, which is kind of frustrating as well, because he can still make those, 12-yard first-down catches and stuff, and they're just kind of ignoring it. But, Fuller, in man coverage, if you play off man, he's going to run you, 10 yards on the field, and then stop and just wait for a nice, easy 12-yard catch. And he's just going to do that over and over again. And then when you climb up, he's going to run right by you. And whenever you're double covering, Hopkins on the other sideline, you have your safety in the middle of the field, and you just get man coverage. And it's pretty much impossible to beat or impossible to stop unless you're able to get a really good press line scrimmage like Malcolm Butler did on that big stop he had on third down on that fade route that was pretty much the same route they threw a touchdown on earlier in the game. Yeah, and then the second thing has to be, Watt. Watt in this game, he had 8 tackles, 3 sacks, 4 tackles for loss, and 4 quarterback hits. And he was the only plus player on the defense. During this game, too, he is the only player on the defense with more than one pressure. Mercer hasn't had a pressure yet. Clowney only had one pressure entering this game. And he's been the entire source of the pass rush as well, too. And so to finally get another vintage Watt game, this is the type of game from Watt we saw in 2014, 2015, 2013, whenever he was carrying the team all on his own. It was so awesome to see, to go back in that time machine and have it be here and actually, watch him completely dominate another game again.
Yeah, the only thing that – I've got a lot to say to what you have said, but I want to go back to Watt because he has been so much fun. But the one thing I noticed, the Giants were chipping him some, but they were leaving, Rhett Ellison one-on-one on him and Wheeler, the right tackle, one-on-one on him.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we're going to see that anymore. If Merciless and Clowney aren't making any noise at all, and let's be honest here, they aren't, I think J.J. Watt's going to get a lot more company on the field these days. But watching him just the inside move for the sack where he basically threw the right tackle, it was Wheeler, down and took him out and then cut inside, threw the right tackle down, was just, man, that was 2013 man crush J.J. Watt time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love the tackle, the 5-yard tackle for a loss in Barkley where he just, takes that one step to the right, watches the tackle, just kind of stands still in a way. It's like Tom Frozen watches the tackle, try to reach his outside shoulder, and then jam and swims back over and then just suffocate, the back. And that's that one-on-one, 5-yard run loss is just, it's even better than a sack, I think, in a way, because you're still getting the same negative amount of yards, but you're doing it in a way that you never see 5 yards lost on a running play, like a dive play like
right.
that. And it just takes so much skill to be able to pull that off. He's been so much fun. I'm super excited to watch the film tomorrow to try to write something on Thursday or Friday about his game this week, because I'm going to work on a film room on. And, I can't wait to actually sit down and do it.
Yeah, and let's talk about Deshaun Watson and DeAndre Hopkins for just a moment, too, because I think that's important. One thing that I pick up, and I'm spitballing this here, one thing I pick up about Deshaun Watson is he has a tendency to really want his receivers to run themselves open.
Yeah.
Right or wrong, and DeAndre Hopkins is not that kind of wide receiver. He's a guy who catches the challenge balls. He's the hand clamp guy. He's going to catch the ball on the sideline. He's going to beat his guy one-on-one, but he's not going to create a ton of separation normally. He's no Will Fuller. He's more of a Larry Fitzgerald kind of guy. Do you kind of get that sense from Deshaun Watson, and that's part of the reason that we're not beating DeAndre Hopkins, even if he's being bracketed? Fitzpatrick, Hoyer, Hopkins was being bracketed when those guys are quarterback too, but they were willing to feed DeAndre Hopkins the ball, Matt.
Yeah, I don't know. Because, like, the weird thing is Watson has really good ball placement. Like, he can put the ball – it'd be even better for him to throw traffic throws than, you know, Hoyer and Fitzpatrick and, you know, name redacted and those guys, because he can actually, like, put the ball in the best spot for it to go. Like, that almost touchdown of Will Fuller that just took Fuller just barely off bounds. He can get that second footed. Like, that's a spectacular pass. Like, that's a kind of like an oh-my-God throw, you know? And so he has the ball placement to do it. I wonder how much of it is also just like coaching and O'Brien, you know, telling him like, you know, don't take risks, don't take too many chances. You know, there's no reason to force feed it whenever you have four on this sideline and that sort of thing. So I haven't picked up that part of it. I think next time I watch actual like coaches film of it, I'll keep that in mind as I watch them play. But you know, they're not going at Hopkins, even whenever he's in like 1-on-1 man coverage and Stephen Gilmore, because they'd rather go to other matchups as well. I think that's also kind of the frustrating things too. That New England game, they put Hopkins in the slot to try to get him away from Stephen Gilmore. He's twice as good as Stephen Gilmore is. He's going to get open. He's going to make the catch over him. Just throw it to him, you know? And I think they're kind of overthinking this Hopkins thing to start the season as well.
Yeah. I just, there has to be something there. And I'm trying to figure out what that something is, because it's driving me up the freaking wall.
Yeah. And, I mean, Hopkins still had, like, I think 8 catches for, like, 92 yards this game, but he hasn't had the type of, like, superhuman game. He hasn't made, like, a great catch so far this year. And that's kind of the strange thing about it, because usually by this time of this year, you know, there's some, like, insane one-handed catch or some, you know, crazy post play where he boxes off the defender, grabs the rebound, and slams it back home, you know. Like, that's just been missing this year. There hasn't been, like, even, like, a definitive Hopkins play yet.
Great points. Yeah, I didn't even think about that. That's fantastic points.
The other thing, I guess, on the offense, let's talk about the offensive line, because they made some moves today. One is that Dylan Cole's on the IR. Two is Bruce Ellington's on the IR. So it probably means that Kike Coate is going to actually play, which is, you know, good news. The team needs somebody another player can run downfield. Another player can potentially beat man coverage as well. And then the other thing they did as well is they moved their – I can't remember his name off the top of my head. They moved an offensive tackle from the practice squad up to the regular roster. So in case Davenport has a bad game or Rankin has a bad game, they can quickly switch. In this one, Davenport had he gave up 5 hurries, a sack, and then he had 4 penalties. He had a Jeff Allen number of 3 false starts, and then he had a holding penalty as well, negated a touchdown that Houston ended up scoring a touchdown on anyways. And then Martinez Rankin was credited with 8 hurries in this one. And watching it live, like, I thought Rankin was fine the first half, I think especially because I could watch him, you know, playing on the left side. And then the second half, guys stopped trying to go around him on the edge. Like, other teams have been beating him. Like, Tennessee just edge-rushed Rankin and Davenport over and over again. And, you know, Rankin was, I think, really kind of sitting on those edge rushes, trying to get out of the stance quick, really hurrying over there to meet the edge rush. And I think he started playing higher, that sort of thing, because in the second half, they were just bull rushing. They both against him and Davenport, they were just bull rushing him and going through him and able to create pressure like that. And there wasn't as many edge rushes as there has been the previous 2 weeks. And that kind of switched in that second half. And so in this week, it seems like they're going to go with them at left and right tackle still. And they're going to have this backup tackle. Things are really bad again. And I think it's kind of the move that you have to make. You either switch him and put Davenport in a place where he's comfortable, because he's comfortable at left tackle. He was better at left tackle last year than he's been at right tackle this year. He was a passable left tackle last year. He played left tackle at training camp all preseason. He switched to right, and now he's completely falling apart. And you either switch him and you hope that works out, or you just can't play Davenport at all anymore because he's unplayable at this point, and it sucks. And, you know, he looked like a potential starting left tackle in the league, and he looked like he got a lot stronger this summer. And he's been an absolute disaster so far this year. And it really breaks my heart. I'm really upset about it. And the other thing that sucks, too, it's like Houston's not doing anything to help out either tackles. They're not chipping. They're playing Ryan Griffin a ton. He played 76% of the snaps. And I believe Jordan Thomas only played – I can look it up exactly. Jordan Thomas only played 22% of the snaps. Aikens only played 37%. Ryan Griffin played 76%. So you're putting a worse blocker with those guys, too, which doesn't help them out. You're not chipping a whole lot. You're not running enough bootlegs. You're not running play action. You're not changing the cadence for the pass rushers. they're just kind of going on one once the center lifts his head, and they have to try to beat their guy from there, one-on-one from there. And it hasn't worked, and it sucks. These guys are in the deep, and they're drowning, and the coaching is not doing anything to help them whatsoever. And it even sucks more because these are, like, talented players. So these are guys who can be who could be, you know, starting tackles in this league, and Houston's just absolutely ruining them right now. And as somebody who has really enjoyed watching both these players heading into this year, like, I've just been kind of devastated. Like, my feelings are hurt watching them play, and the whole thing just sucks so much.
Yeah, and I want to take a moment out because I've been really interested in watching the quote-unquote battle at tight end. And I just want to put this in perspective. Perspective is always important for me. Ryan Griffin has 10 targets and 3 receptions for 63 yards. Jordan Thomas, 7 targets, 3 receptions for 80 yards. And Jordan Akins, 5 targets, 5 receptions for 50 yards. Ryan Griffin is the worst blocking tight end of that trio. I don't know why
I've seen who blocks as much as he does.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I just don't, he's not, so he's neither effective as a blocker nor as a pass catcher. So this goes back to, once again, why the hell is dude on the field? Right? He's the least effective receiver of that group. And he's the least effective blocker. I get the other two are rookies, but it does not matter if you're the worst. So why is Ryan Griffin seeing snaps at this point?
Yeah, I think it's kind of like the Garrett, like he's the same player as Garrett Graham, except for whatever reason they've held on to Ryan Griffin. You know, they signed Graham that year for like 3 years, $10 million. They cut him like 4 weeks into the year because he was terrible. And Griffin has been able to hang around and hang around and hang around. I understand it. Like he catches seam passes when he's wide open, nobody's covering him, but constantly he's not able to beat man coverage. And one of the other things I've noticed too, you know, kind of talking about the offensive line, as well as that, like, Watson's holding onto the ball forever as well. And there's not, like, pick-and-pop passes. There's nothing super easy happening. Everything's really difficult. It's a lot of holding, waiting for somebody to beat man coverage, and usually doesn't happen. And then all of a sudden he's scrambling, and now the offensive line looks a lot worse than it is because you can't block for, you know, 5 seconds consistently. And I know they're having trouble, like, blocking for 2 seconds at times, and, you know, Watson's getting, you know, destroyed immediately. Like, even then, even when the pass blocking is good, like, nothing's open. And Watson's just searching and looking and looking and looking. And like, one way to help that is by getting open in the middle of the field. And also, when pressure is bad, you want open passes in the middle of the field because it's a shorter path over there. And you want guys to meet man coverage. And both Akins and Thomas are better being man coverage than Griffin has. And Griffin's never been able to really do it all very well. And just another one of those things is just, like, just very dumb and doesn't make any sense, and I really don't get it all.
Yeah, so I really wanted to bring up that tight end situation too. And it's really because, and I got to just admit it, you know, fair disclosure and all that, Huggy and I have a bet on Ryan Griffin, and I think that Ryan Griffin's not going to lead the tight ends in catches because he does not even deserve to be seeing the field at all. So there you go,
yeah.
Fair disclosure.
Yeah, he has, what, 3 right now, I guess, on 7 targets. I think even entering last week, I think he only had 1 catch in this game, so I think he was only at 2 for 6, and I think he was even at 1 for 6 at one point to start this year as well, whenever I was looking at the numbers, I think a week or two ago. So, I mean, it's been bad.
Yeah.
It's not like this is something new either.
No, and he's the worst on the team. I mean, he's 3 for 10 on targets. I mean, 30%. I could throw – I could go out there and catch 30% of my targets. Actually, I had good hands back in the day, but I mean, that's trash. I mean, that's straight trash to have that low of a target rate or target and catch rate.
Yeah. And also, like, the middle of the field is wide open too. When you have Fuller on one sideline, you have Hopkins on the other sideline, so much attention is drawn to the sidelines. Like, it should be easy for Griffin and the Jordan rookies and for whoever the slot receiver is going to be. It should be easy for them to get open in the middle of the field. And they're not doing it all. And also, like, it doesn't help that O'Brien doesn't scheme the game body open. He doesn't create any open throws whatsoever. And again, like, I didn't see a one route combination between Fuller and DeAndre Hopkins until 2:20 left in the third quarter. And that's completely unacceptable. And when they ran it, Fuller got wide open on a slant route and had like a 20-yard reception off of it. And it's just like, it's not like super complicated things that you have to do. Or like situations, you know, to put yourself in advantages. And it's even like a secondary that's missing, like Eli Apple, who played pretty well entering this year too. Like the Giants don't have a good secondary, and still even then, like it's not clicking with them too.
Yep.
I don't know. I don't have a whole lot to say about the offense anymore. The one thing I wanted, though, to bring up was the defensive secondary, and I guess the pass rush, too, because Manning completed 25 of his 29 passes this game. That comes out to a completion percentage of 86%. And Manning's been bad to start this year. The pass rush has killed him. He's been inaccurate. He's thrown plenty of interceptions. He also threw 297 yards and 2 touchdowns. The Giants' passing offense so far this year has primarily been Manning's either pressured or he doesn't throw the ball downfield and just dumps it off to Saquon Barkley for like 4 yards a catch. And this game, he had like a super effective one. And it seemed like Romeo Crennel was kind of a no-man situation because he could either play man coverage and get beat and give up like a 15-yard gain and the pass rush doesn't get there in time, or he could play soft zone coverage and the ball is out quickly. He gets beat for, you know, 8 yards and the pass rush doesn't have a chance to get there. So, like, if you're Crennel, what changes would you make, you know, to try to help this out? Or do you think there's just, like, not a lot he can do unless Clowney and Merciless and Watt are all being their pass blocks one-on-one?
I thought about this question. I thought about this a lot because we predicted what would happen, didn't we? I mean, we flat out said if they can do this with their guys and get them, because the pass rush isn't doing it, how do you take – you know, sorry for the Tyrann Mathieu fanboys. And good reason. He used to be a really good football player. He's looked good at times this year. But if your cornerbacks are Jonathan Joseph and Kareem Jackson, neither of whom can keep up with anybody who runs 4.5 or faster at this point, if your safeties are Mathieu and, oh my gosh, I'm blanking. Not Andre.
Reed.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And the only guy who's got long speed back there is Aaron Colvin, and even his long speed is not great. We don't have a lot of good short quickness guys back there either. So you saw Beckham just running past Kareem Jackson, and Kareem Jackson's just flailing. But what do you do? If you put them on press, they're going to get blown off the line. Play them soft, they're going to get beat after 2 seconds. If our pass rush isn't there, that's not going to happen either. And we have to look at this realistically. The saying is, the pass rush can't negate your poor defensive back play. That is not true. It can help it by getting there. But the only guy getting there is J.J. Watt right now. You're really doomed. But those two units work as a symbiotic group. And it doesn't matter. You could put J.J. Watt, Kevin Green, Mean Joe Green, and I'm just going to go old school, Curly Cole on the defensive line, and to try to get to the quarterback against those cornerbacks are trying to throw out there, if they've got any speed at all, the wide receivers, they're going to get open and get open quickly. And mm-hmm. Zach Cunningham was straight up an embarrassment on Sunday. That there is a reason teams are really going after Zach Cunningham. So there's a lot of Sisyphean efforts going on by our defense right now, especially by guys like J.J. Watt, because if you look at the rest of that squad, it's hot garbage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and like even the pass distribution of this game is hilarious because Barkley caught 5 catches on 5 targets for 35 yards, you know, long on 21. Odell Beckham Jr. caught 9 catches on 10 targets for 109 yards. Sterling Shepard caught 6 catches on 7 targets for 80 yards. And Rhett Ellison caught 3 catches or had 3 catches on 3 targets for 33 yards. So like all these guys were getting open. They were all catching their passes. Nobody was influencing the catch. And like, there was just nothing there. And so, like, entering this season, my biggest thing was that the pass rush has to be healthy. If the pass rush is healthy, this defense can be good. And the Texans will only need to score, you know, 24 points, 27 points to win games, which I think they could have entering this year. And they have kind of to a point. I just didn't think they were going to be able to score, you know, 34 points a game or so like they did last year, namely because of the Deshaun Watson touchdown rate. And I just assumed the pass rush was going to be good. Like, I thought, like, you know, if the guys were healthy, it was going to be really good, and that wouldn't be a concern at all. And this year, that's not what has happened. And that's been the biggest surprise to me. Like, I could see the O'Brien thing happening because he's done it plenty of times before. But for a pass rush with Merciless healthy, with Clowney healthy, with Watt healthy, with, you know, McKinney's ability to blitz as well, too, I really did not see this coming at all whatsoever, that both Clowney and Mercer would be as bad as they've been, because they've been completely non-existent. And without that pass rush cranking, like, the secondary is just a bad secondary. They don't have enough talent on it. They're old. They're slow. There's, like, really not a whole lot that they can do at all whatsoever defensively. And with that, and then with, you know, giving up 27 points and having the offensive scheme stuff you have going on and the lack of blocking, the penalties, it's just been a complete, like, you know, wreck whatsoever. Do you think Merciless and Clowney are going to play any better this year? And, like, have you seen things specifically that they're struggling with?
Well, Clowney's got to be on the field for every game and not getting penalties in civvies. Matt, I got to say, I have not seen any reason to be optimistic about Clowney or Merciless at all this year. I mean, like, no reason. They're both getting stood up one-on-one. Merciless has always had this problem. And he had a couple years where he got a lot of garbage sacks, but he has always, since he's been in the NFL, has had a hard time with one-on-one blocks. He's just flat out no longer beating them. He's not even getting the outliers of them. He's not even getting the garbage, J.J. Watt's garbage anymore. Clowney just does not look like the same guy we saw occasionally the first couple of years. By the way, let's just go for on the record and say that Khalil Mack is a hell of a lot better of a football player than Clowney is. Can we just put that little argument to rest for once and for all? Because if you're still arguing for Clowney, you're being ridiculous. But there's no reason to be optimistic for these guys at this point. They've got to do something. Merciless has got to show something. Clowney's got to show something. They didn't do it against the freaking Giants, Matt. I don't know when they're going to do it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's going to get better because Merciless, like, he had his best year in 2016, whenever Watt went down. Like, he was legitimately being tackles on the edge one-on-one with rip moves. Clowney was creating pressures. He wasn't having the sacks, but he was still one of the best edge run defenders in football. And I feel like last year he was the best run-stopping defensive end in football last year without Watt there. And this year, like, I mean, they haven't done anything at all whatsoever. And I think part of it maybe has to do with this training camp. You know, Merciless had that hamstring injury. He didn't play a lot whatsoever. Clowney had that surgery, and they brought him back really slowly this summer. And so I think maybe they're having to play themselves back into football shape and, like, get used to being on the field. And that's really the only thing I can think of because, you know, like, the talent's still there. Like, this is still, like, really, you know, good talent. These are still guys who are really good players. But they're getting blocked by, you know, Nate Solder, and they're getting blocked by Hernandez, and they were getting blocked by Wheeler. And they're going against the offensive line that's been, you know, bad to start the year as well, too. And the other thing about this game is Crennel did blitz. Like, he was blitzing the safeties predominantly blitz, and they weren't getting there as well either. The Giants are picking up blitzes, something they haven't been able to do against Jacksonville or against Dallas even. And his blitzes weren't working as well. So, I mean, he has to do something, whether it's – I think he should play Edgy Ofer on the edge. He should try to get Watt and Clowney maybe rushing a little bit closer, unless there's some, like, really good one-on-one matchup Clowney can take advantage of, and then put Merciless maybe on the other edge, so that way Clowney and Watt have shorter pass to the quarterback. And then whenever blitzing, like, get McKinney in some blitzes, put, you know, Clowney and Merciless over the center and get some of those interior blitzes as well too, because they're not getting any pressure at all by putting, you know, Covington and Blackson and Dunn and, you know, Reeder on the inside rushing on third downs. It's not working all the inside. And it's just making, you know, that much easier to step up from that exterior pressure and that sort of thing as well, too. So there's things that they can do to be better. I think Clowney and Merciless will get better, but it's just been, like, non-existent. I think they were 30th in pressure rate entering this week, and it will be hard because Watt was spectacular on his own. But overall, the pass rush has just been, you know, putrid and, you know, non-existent.
Yeah, and I would just like to talk for a moment about the personnel problem. We talked about it last week. Why is Clowney on the outside? Why isn't he playing defensive end in the 3-4 base set? Why isn't he inside? Why isn't Watt inside on sub packages? Why the hell are Dunn and Blackson and those kind of guys getting so many snaps? They should not. Right? We should be seeing out there on our base package, we should be seeing a front three of Watt. Excuse me, and Clowney, we should be seeing Merciless and Ejiofor on the outside and Cunningham and McKinney on the inside. That's what we should be seeing from our front seven. Instead, we're seeing a lot of Covington and Dunn in there at the same time. look, we're not even playing our best guys. We're not bringing our best guys to the fight. And it's on sub-packages, seeing those guys out there is just an atrocity. And J.J. Watt, love the guy. He destroyed the right tackle this past week. We've talked often about how he's still much more effective on the inside. Why isn't he shooting the A and B gap? Sometimes it's perplexing. I understood why Vrabel did it, because Vrabel didn't know what the hell he was doing. And the reason that Cornell started blitzing on Sunday, and because we hadn't been doing a whole lot of blitzing until Sunday, but the reason is everybody could see that it was like 1-on-6 to get to the quarterback. And mm-hmm. So he had to start blitzing. He had to start doing something different. And I would not doubt if we see a lot more blitzing this week, just because we gotta.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, like, you know, talking about the Watt at the defensive end spot in this game, I want to see him rush from the defensive end spot when those matchup advantages are there. Like, there's no reason to give Clowney that matchup advantage when he hasn't shown his – he's been a fine at creating pressure, but he has some of the pass rush moves that Watt has. To take advantage of a guy like Wheeler, like, you're just matching athleticism versus athleticism, which you win, but you can't get their ass quick when you're constantly trying to run through and around guys rather than, get by them in a quicker fashion like Watt can. So whenever you get Wheeler out there, right tackle, put Watt on him and then kind of sort everything else from there. But if you're in a situation where you have two, pretty good booking tackles, there's no reason to keep Watt on the outside. Move him inside, get Merciless and Edgy over one-on-one matchups, give Watt and Clowney having to deal with the center and guard at the same time. And then that will even open up your blitzes as well too. So I know Edgy over will play 9 snaps. You should play a lot more than that. I really want to see Clowney move back to defensive end too. He was so good defensive end last year. Like, why make him play stand up because of the idea that you need to fill in these spots or whatever? Just get your best guys out there and then kind of go from there. And I really would like to see Clowney playing defensive end because he looked a lot more comfortable there last year than, and even in 2016 as well too, when Watt got hurt, than he has ever playing standing up at all.
Hey, Big Matt, I got a question for you, man.
Yeah.
I'm going to rephrase this. Rushing the quarterback, what is J.J. Watt's best move?
It's either like the edge rip, which he's way better at than he should be. But, I mean, it's a swim move, though.
Is a swim move more effective on the outside or the inside?
It's more of an inside move because you can't really swim after you take 3 steps. Like, it's kind of an immediate thing because you're already close. You're already really – it's more like a move in tight quarters because if you do it on the edge – that swim, the tackle is more of a chance to recover because you have more space between the two.
Have you ever seen a better swim move than J.J. Watt's? Name two players.
Michael Phelps and Mark Davis.
Right? Right. So if J.J. Watt, I mean, I'm almost 50 years old now, believe it or not. I'm almost 50. I've never seen a better swim move than J.J. Watt's. So... why isn't he playing on the inside using his best tool, using his best weapon? Even if you were to tell the guy, this is like in the days when the catchers would tell the hitters that Nolan Ryan is going to throw his fastball. I mean, they would tell the hitters that just to show them up. Even if you were to tell the guard facing against J.J. Watt, look, he's going to do the swim move. You just try to stop it. Like, Watt's still going to be successful, so why put him outside? So why do we vetch about that quite a bit? It's because it's just such an obvious thing. Legendary swim move, don't line him up in a 9-wide technique, okay?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, I'm okay with the 9-wide technique when he's going against Wheeler, but whenever they're playing, whenever they're playing the Cowboys and you have Tyron Smith there, maybe don't play him on the left tackle. Put him against Connor Williams. Like, find your best matchup and let Watt work from there. I think that's the best way to kind of use him. And I'm just super happy that he's back and he's healthy and he's playing well because I really miss watching him play football. Let's go through, I guess, these few listener questions, and then we'll talk about the Colts game briefly, and we'll kind of go from there. Whenever we have these kind of podcasts after bad losses like this, it becomes a lot of, like, bigger picture thinking and talking about O'Brien. And we spend 25 minutes, with the – airing out all of our grievances and stuff. And it's like pretty much like marriage counseling. And then we feel a lot better. And then we can actually have a good time. So the first reader question I have is from actually a friend of mine named Sam. And BFT said, what will be the first game the Texans will win this season?
Oh, God. Really? That's your question for me?
Yeah, that's the question.
Son of a gun.
They play the Colts this week, the Cowboys the week after, the Bills after that, then the Jaguars, Dolphins, Broncos.
The problem is it should be, like, the Colts. We should romp the Colts. I mean, we should. The Colts are trash. Look, I still don't care what anybody says. The Colts are trash. I think we might have to wait until we play the Bills. I don't care what the Bills did on Sunday against the Vikings. I don't care what anybody says about Josh Allen right now. The league is going to adjust, and Josh Allen's going to go back to doing Allen things. So I think we might wind up actually having to wait for the Bills. I have no faith in this team to let me take a step back from this a little bit. The Houston Texans historically under Bill O'Brien have really done nothing but punch down. They've only been able to beat not only teams that are kind of below our threshold, but are just straight out poor football teams. The Colts kind of qualify for that, even though they're not really showing that this year. So it kind of makes me want to say, no, that's not going to be the game. The Buffalo Bills are they're one of the worst football teams I've ever seen, especially on paper. So I think we're going to have to wait for that because they're the only type of team Bill O'Brien can consistently beat are the worst team in the league. They can beat the BSFs when they're 2-14 and the Glitter Kitties when they're 2-14 and the Cincinnati Bengals when they're 11-5. That's who we beat. So that's I think we wait for the Bills, Matt.
Yeah, I feel the same way too. I think I'm tired of picking the Texans to win these games, like last thing, like the Titans game, and have them lose it as well too. And like. I don't know, the Colts, like, their front seven has been spicy this year. And, yeah, we can talk more about them in a second, but I would say the Bills as well. The next question we have here is from Meigs. He had two questions. The first one is, what's the big picture strategy going forward? Build around the current core, do a Brown-style tank and rebuild, both without O'Brien, I assume.
Yeah, so Bill O'Brien's got to be the first cog to go. We have to get somewhere he's going to take advantage of Deshaun Watson. I've been saying it for a while now. Matt LaFleur is my number one with the bullet, the offensive coordinator for the Titans. He's part of the Shanahan coaching tree. Shanahan's part of the Kubiak coaching tree. Look, I think that is where we really need to go. Focus on a guy who knows how to call an offense. You can go out and get good defensive guys. Look, I would keep Romeo Cornell in a second if I'm Matt LaFleur. Hey, I'm going to give you the 70-year-old guy who still knows how to run a defense as long as he's got the personnel, like they're not all old and decrepit like me. But put LaFleur in charge of that offense, I think you're going to see beautiful things happen. Do I burn this team down? I absolutely do not burn this team down. At the rate Seattle's going, we're going to have several good draft picks this year. We need to redo our secondary to a certain degree. Cornerbacks, clearly a tackle would not help or would not hurt. But look, as poor as the offensive line has been, let's go back to what Big Matt was talking about earlier. You put Davenport at left tackle, put Rankin at right tackle, let the dudes play what really the positions they are built to play. And let's see what happens because the offensive line is going to get better. I'm very, very confident in that. So I don't think the offensive line is going to be a nightmare by the end of the season, but we definitely need help in the secondary. We could use another weapon or two offensively, especially at tight end. There is a good, solid core here. It's not like we're talking about the Browns where they had nothing at most positions for several years, aside from Joe Thomas. There is a really tight core here. You get good coaching. Look, even I thought this team had the potential to go 12-4 this year. Even I did. So there's too much of a core here to kind of whisk it away, Matt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree.
That was really ranty.
Yeah, it's been a lot of rants. I bet we've just been playing we're playing like a campaign of a single player video game. And we're just kind of like sitting on the couch passing the controller back and forth after levels, more so than a conversation. Which is kind of how it happens whenever y'all riled up after kind of some of these things. But no, I agree with you completely. This isn't a talent issue with this team right now. Like every day we're witnessing, like, this isn't, there's nothing wrong with the talent here. You're not going to be good at everything with the way the salary cap is set up. The Texans didn't have, you know, any draft capital last year because of decisions that they made as well, too. You name of the trade for Watson, and also the name redacted trade was terrible. It's always been terrible. It continues to be terrible. And so, like, moving forward, like, you don't – and they're also, like, they've hit on their first-round pick. So, you know, the talent's here. The issues here is coaching. The Texans are 0-3 because of O'Brien. They're 0-3 because of coaching specifically. So I wouldn't say that you would burn everything and you down trade people for picks and strip everything with spare parts and build around Watson at all. I think you just kind of, I would fire O'Brien today, get a different head coach because 0-3 the playoffs are kind of over. See what you have, what you could have in Cronell or whatever. Maybe you win 5 games, you have a high draft pick next year, and then you can already start your new head coaching search and think about that. Because right now, that's what's holding this team back. It's not a big talent thing. And, you know, sure, like, but there's positions that can be filled and things can get better, but they have a ton of cap space already. They're going to have a ton of draft capital next year. So like the opportunity is already there for them to be another good team again next year, even if it hasn't happened this year.
Well said.
And then the last listener question we had was from our good friend, Uprooted Texan. If you missed it, he called Bill O'Brien Brain from Pinky and the Brain. And Brain's the rat with the big old head and the big brain who's very mean. And there's Pinky who's, you know, very dumb and silly. But then there's also like those conspiracy theories out there that Pinky's actually the smart one and Brain's the really dumb one. And I haven't seen the show since I was, you know, 7 years old as a latchkey kid waiting for, you know, my mother to come home. So I can't really speak exactly what it is. But UT asked BFD, if Bill O'Brien was to try to take over the world, what would his plan be and how do you think it would be thwarted?
First, Uprooted, first, whenever we start our day and the kids ask, and they are so well-trained, and if either kid ever asks, what are we doing today, my wife and I look at each other, like, completely frustrated, perplexed, because we say the same thing. We're going to try to take over the world. And so for you to insult me like that because I'm old and – wait, what are we talking about? Anyway, yes, so I know Pinky and the Brain. Thank you, UT. Hugs. So how would Brain O'Brien try to take over the world? God. He would put garlic powder on people's food because he thinks they'd knock them out.
There you go.
Yeah.
That's good. I like that.
Come out. I didn't say that correctly. That's it. Here comes the whiskey, everybody.
I like that. yeah, I never understood that whenever people make jokes like why people don't know how to season their food, because I've never had that experience before. And then like watching Bill O'Brien for these last 4 years, like I kind of get it now. I feel like everything's just, you know, mayonnaise and cheese and bread with him. But I don't really have anything to add to your garlic powder thing. So let's talk about this Sunday's game. The Texans are playing the Colts. The Colts are currently 1-2. They lost a close game to the Bengals. Then they beat the Washington football team by like a really like kind of strange defensive effort where Alex Smith refused to throw the ball to the outside at all, and they tackled really well. And they almost beat the Eagles last year, but Derek Barnett made like a game-saving, you know, Super Bowl-esque sack to win the game in it. So that's what they're up against this week. Now, I've watched all three of those Colts games. I caught back up on football. I'm a football guy again. What do you think about Andrew Luck? Do you think he's back? How has he looked to you so far?
What really – if you're a Colts fan, and you shouldn't be, if you're a Colts fan and you see that 5.3 yards per attempt that he's throwing up there versus his career 7.1, you really have to ask yourself, is Andrew Luck really healthy? And I don't think the answer is yes, Big Matt. I just don't. So from what I've seen, it's just throwing a lot of short passes, getting rid of it. Yes, I get that part of it. He just doesn't want to get hit anymore. He's times already this year. I guess that's not too gross, but I just don't think Andrew Luck is back. And if Andrew Luck isn't back, then I don't see how the Colts are even remotely decent. I don't care what their defense has done so far this year. I hate this team. I hate the talent or the lack of talent they've got on this team. Like, even if you look at their defense, it's just 12th as well as they've played. I think that's going to go back. I don't know. I hate this team, Big Matt.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're underselling their defense after I watched them. I was really like, I've been really kind of strangely impressed by their defense considering they didn't really put any money at all into this past year. And Ballard's just been like making mid-round draft picks and kind of adding pieces here and there. But going back to Luck, so yeah, Luck has a yards per attempt of 5.3 right now, which I really had no idea after watching all of his games even. Do you know he's better than one quarterback? One quarterback is 32nd in football. Do you know which quarterback has a worse yards per attempt than Andrew Luck?
Well, it ain't Ryan Fitzpatrick. That's for dadgum sure.
Yeah, he's first at 11.1.
God, he just chunks the ball downfield. Isn't he fun to watch?
Yeah, it's. I'm still gonna never fully like him because of 2014, and but yeah, he's been incredible this year.
Wow, Taylor.
Now Taylor is 28th at 5.5. Sam Bradford at 5.0. That's the only quarterback Andrew Luck has attempted more yards per attempt than. And I mean, like watching him, like it's starting to click now because I was watching him, and I was really surprised by just like the lack of arm strength with him. I mean, he's just floating passes up, like it looks like Case Keenum deep balls when he's throwing 7-yard out passes. And it's really kind of like super weird too watching him play because the intelligence is there, the pocket mobility is there, the pocket awareness is there, the touch is there, the accuracy there. But the arm strength isn't there whatsoever. And so it's kind of like a really interesting like quarterback case study as well too, especially when we talk about the draft. You're like, well, this guy's in the best arm, but he can do this, this, and this, and this. And it's like a Teddy Bridgewater thing, you know? Like Bridgewater's knock was even skinny. His arm's not that good, but he's so good at all these different things. And that other thing, the arm strength thing does matter. It's important. And Luck doesn't have any arm strength at all right now. And it's just like, it's super weird to see. It's like the football is like a balloon you got from Supercuts that you've blown up and you're trying to throw it, you know, 15 yards, and he just can't do it. And it's weird. It's really eerie. But, like, everything else is there. And I think the concern is if you're the Colts, like, is this something that he's rehabilitating from and will get better at? Or is this just kind of going to be Luck forever? And even that Eagles game, they benched him and brought Jacoby Brissett in to throw the Hail Mary. Because Luck can't throw the football 45 yards all anymore. So they bring in, you know, Brissett just to throw the last pass because Luck can't get the ball to the end zone from, you know, 45, 50 yards at all, which is just it's just so strange.
Yeah, that's when I saw that happen, I was blown away. That tells me everything I need to know. And what if you're so we've talked about like ACL tears. That, you know, when you get them fixed, normally it should be stronger because the ACL has been had a lot of wear and tear. Then you put a new thing in there and it's going to be stronger. The shoulder doesn't work like that. The shoulder really, really doesn't work like that. And after Drunkie hit me and I had my shoulder surgery, and here I am 5 years post-shoulder surgery, my shoulder's still freaking weak, right? It's not something that just gets stronger. It's really a lot harder to rehab that kind of injury. That's why pitchers, whenever they get the shoulder injuries, they have a tendency to not be so swell afterward. It's just with the body part, how it reacts to injury. And so if you're looking at Andrew Luck, had this really hard time with his shoulder that he had to sit out so long. You know, there's probably reasons for that. And I don't know if he's ever going to be Andrew Luck again. It's so rare that something like that fixes itself. I mean, look at the NFL quarterbacks. The only one I can think of that's had major shoulder surgery and come back to be very successful is Drew Brees. I mean, these are the sorts of injuries that you count on one hand that people come back successfully from.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, it's super weird. The only good thing that's kind of come from Andrew Luck's inability to throw the ball with any muster at all is that it constantly leads to all these underthrown throws downfield. And so T.Y. Hilton drew like three defensive pass interference penalties that game because he would stop, come back to the ball, and the defensive backs, you know, running to keep up with him, and then he stops right in front of them, and they get like 35 free yards. So that's the only good thing that's come out of it. But other than that, like it's really weird. And going back to Hilton has historically killed Houston in his career. He has 63 catches on 104 targets. for 1,131 yards, which comes up to 17.95 yards a catch, and also 9 touchdowns. So are you worried about that combination, or does Luck's shoulder not really concern you? And also, how are you expecting they're going to cover Hilton? Is it going to be a lot of man coverage against Kareem Jackson, Jonathan Joseph? How do you think they're going to go about that matchup?
Okay, all you have to do for me, if you're the Colts, and if you know anything about the foosballs, and you just watched and saw what putting Beckham in the slot with Kareem Jackson covering him, and saw what Beckham could do to Kareem Jackson just on a simple slant, I'm just lining up Hilton in the slot all day, and just look, even Andrew Luck can throw the ball 15 yards. So that to me is the matchup to watch, is where they're going to line up Hilton, what they're going to do to Kareem Jackson, what they're going to do to anybody who's covering Hilton. Because we're going to, even if he's in the slot, you're going to have to bracket the dude because he's so fast, nobody on the team can keep with him.
Mm-hmm. And also, like, Kareem Jackson's bad turning around for the ball also. And under throw by 5 yards, like, you're going to get like a free, like, you know, 35 yards, because that's as far as Luck can throw the ball right now as well too. So defensively, they kept Carson Wentz. You know, he just came back to 20 points. They held Washington to 9 points the week before. I haven't looked at the overall numbers. I haven't checked out the DVOA numbers yet because, you know, looking at yards and points, points is better than yards, but yards is a bad way to look at a performance of a team overall like that. But I do like this defense. Like, Darius Leonard's a really good blitzer. He's a playmaker. He's a second-round pick that they have from South Carolina State. Jabal Sheard is the most underrated pass rusher in football.
Mm-hmm.
Marcus Hunt has come out of nowhere and turns like this, like Kyle Vandenbosch. He's been spectacular to start the season. Al Woods has been a really great run defender. The other linebacker they have playing next to Leonard in their nickel situations, he's been making plays as well too. And they don't really have any cornerback talent, but like Malik Hooker has the potential to be like an Earl Thomas level, like pass defender. He's never going to be able to tackle that Thomas was, and like the hitter that Thomas was, but he has that same sort of range where he can just make some absurd plays to influence, you know, any deep pass, you know, at all available. And their strong safety Gethard has been, you know, atrocious, but like their front seven's been surprisingly spunky. You know, Hooker is good. They're hard to throw downfield on, and the outside is the best place to beat them up. But like, I mean, they've been really surprising, especially with their stunts and their defensive line, their pass rush. Like, I've been, like, super impressed, and I thought this was going to be a team that was going to give up, you know, 28 points a game or so, and they've been far away from that. Like, they've, you know, locked down Washington. They played, you know, great against Philadelphia last week, too.
No, not buying. Sorry, Matt.
All right. Well, you'll buy maybe after this week, but they've been good. I mean, I don't know if you've watched them really yet at all, but they've been good. They would have beat Indy, but Carson Wentz drew one of those, like, really weak roughing the passer calls on 4th and 5. They gave him an automatic first down. Otherwise, the Eagles probably would have lost that game.
Wow. Yeah, no, I did not get to watch that game. I was away for that's the one thing about Sunday I should actually, you know, talk about out loud is I really enjoyed seeing ballet off the Firebird a lot more than I watched watching the Houston Texans. I mean, again, I love the ballet. I mean, I absolutely do. I think it's the ultimate in athleticism. But, man, watching the Texans play and watching the fantastic performers at Austin Ballet, not even in comparison right now.
Are you going back to ballet this Sunday, or are you going to watch this game?
Oh, no, it was a one-weekend thing. But if I have to miss another – yeah, so – It's hard on the dancers.
Whenever they come out with the DVD for the end of the 2018 season, you should say Houston Texans. You should have went to the ballet instead. But the Colts defense has been really surprised. They're still kind of taken aback by it, especially Marcus Hunt. Like, I can't get over as good as he's been to start this year as well too. So what's your prediction for this one? Who do you have winning this game? Do you think the Texans are going to snap this losing streak, or is it going to keep going and going and going?
Oh, stop it, Matt. I'm already dead inside. Oh, my God. I'm almost 50 years old, y'all. I've been watching Houston football since I was like 5. I've never seen a team as perplexing as the current Texans squad, and there's a couple reasons for that. We know the reasons. We know that Bill O'Brien is a terrible head coach. We know that the defensive backs are old and slow. This is a really, really hard team to predict. This is going to be one of the few times. I get the home road thing, and I don't always kind of go against that just because it's a home road thing, but I'm going to take the Colts on this game. I'm going to take them 24-16. And that's 3 field goals and 1 touchdown by the Texans. I just want to make that very clear that that's going to be the ratio there.
Yeah, why not 4 field goals and 2 safeties instead?
I thought about that. And that might be more realistic. I mean, it is Bill O'Brien. I mean, good gosh. I mean, you want him to put what on his toast?
Yeah, I have Indy winning 23-20. The Texans have lost 3 one-possession games to start this year. Their expected win-loss record is 1.1 to 1.9 based off their point differential. So, I mean, they have been unlucky, but they've also been the worst coached football team I've watched this year. And, like, also, I've watched, I think, all the condensed games from Sunday except for 3 right now. And, like, just watching what Carolina's done with their injuries to the offensive line and, like, without nearly as much talent as Houston has on theirs, and it's just unbelievable just the difference in what they get out of theirs. To see what Jacksonville has done with Allen as their left tackle after losing Cam Robinson has been great as well, too. Like, all these teams have dealt with offensive line injuries, but only Houston can put a competent offensive line together even with everybody healthy. But anyways, I mean, this team is just poorly coached. I do really like the Colts defense, which is, like, I like them as far as I'm surprised that they're mediocre. Like, I'm surprised that they're, like, the 16th best defense in football because I thought they're going to be, like, the 30th best. Andrew Luck is still super smart. I think he can do just enough. And I think Bill O'Brien will continue to hold the offense back. So I have the Colts winning 23-20. And it's also one of those things, too, like, I'm not expecting Houston to win a game this year until it actually happens because right now I'm unsure if that's even a possibility out in this this infinite reality we live in.
I'm looking at the rest of UT's questions that he's posted, and I mean, seriously, the Hateful Nate's responses, don't post on your own Shiza immediately, makes you look small, mod. I just don't even, yeah. Sometimes people just shouldn't post on the blog. I'm just saying.
Yeah, arguing about something online is never a very enjoyable experience. But making friends online and talk online is okay sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, it's just really funny that the responses are so just freaking poor. It's just hilarious. Anyway.
Yeah. So anyways, that's what we have for the show tonight. If you're listening live, thank you for listening live. If you're listening recorded, cool. I think there may be some changes happening in the podcast in the next, you know, week or two as far as recording live or not, and how SB Nation's doing some things. So we'll probably have to type a post maybe a week or two once all that gets finalized and sorted out. And it won't change this show or what we're doing. It's still going to be here, and we'll still be doing the show on Tuesday nights and that sort of thing. But anyways, enjoy trying to watch this game on Sunday. Hopefully you have fun doing it. Hopefully some interesting thing happens. Hopefully, like, O'Brien actually runs a competent enough offense. But anyway, thanks for listening to the show. My name is not Weston. Thank you for talking to me tonight, BFT.
Woo!